The first approved gene therapy case in the United States took place on September 14, 1990, at the National Institute of Health in Maryland. The patient was a 4-year-old girl named Ashanti De Silva, who suffered from severe combined immune deficiency, a rare genetic disease. To treat her, the doctors removed the white blood cells from her body, inserted the missing genes into the cells, and then infused the genetically modified blood cells back into her bloodstream. As a result of the gene therapy, De Silva now has a functional immune system and leads a normal life. Although gene therapy was first developed to treat rare genetic diseases, it is now being applied to treatment of acquired diseases such as cancer, arthritis, as well as wound and bone healing. However, gene therapy is still an experimental procedure performed on only very few carefully selected patients under strict regulation by government agencies. We are fortunate to have with us tonight to discuss this groundbreaking field, Paul Robbins, Professor of Microbiology, Molecular Genetics, and Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. He recently was the director of the Virus Vector Core Facility, director of basic research for the Molecular Medicine Institute, and co-director of the Paul Wellstone Cooperative Muscular Research Center. He was a member of the PASB study section and chair of the Italian Telething Scientific Review Committee. He has also served as a member of the Scientific Review Board of National Gene Vector Laboratory and was a member of the Board of Directors of American Society of Gene Therapy. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. Also, since this program is being recorded and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for the microphone to reach you before asking a question during a question and answer session at the end of the program. Now, thank you, and please join me in welcoming Paul Robbins.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Is this on? I like to pace around, so I'm going to use this mic. I'd like to thank Sherry for a very nice and somewhat embarrassing introduction. I'd like to acknowledge the students who I met with this afternoon who asked a number of very interesting questions. I was very impressed. I'd like to thank the host for a very nice dinner, although I'm not sure why they give a lot of wine to the speakers before the talk and not after, but we'll see how that goes. And also I'd like to just say I'm a little, this is a little tough for me. This is the first time I've ever given a talk in front of my daughter. So I'm a little more nervous than usual, so I apologize if I start to act a little flustered at some point, because my daughter is a junior here at Dickinson, and so it's a great honor to be here and actually get to talk in front of this crowd. I'm also a little concerned, because I've looked at the list of speakers you've had in this series, and there have been some excellent speakers in a number of different areas, and I'm not sure if I can make gene therapy interesting enough to this audience, but I'm going to try. And so what I want to do is to give you kind of an overview initially of gene therapy. So I want to describe to you what I think gene therapy is. This isn't a traditional definition, but what I think it is. Discuss really the two different approaches you can take towards developing the gene therapy, and then try to introduce to this diverse audience the concept of how we actually introduce genes into cells using vectors. So this isn't a virology lecture. This isn't a molecular biology lecture, but I will have to mention a few terms and show a few slides that may be a little difficult, but I'll try to keep it simple for those who are not biologists. I then want to try to convince you that gene therapy, which started, as Sherry alluded to, some 20 years ago, that's had some false starts, some setbacks, actually has moved forward as fast or faster than I expected, and there are a number of clinical successes. And so I'm going to talk about a few of these, in particular, gene therapy approaches for treating severe combined immunodeficiencies. And I'll give you two examples, one that's been highly successful, one that's been successful but with had several setbacks, but a few complications, which I'd like to raise with you. And then given the fact that I'd like to talk about I do, I actually want to talk about one of the clinical trials that I ran some years ago, and that was developing a gene therapy for arthritis. And this actually was interesting at the time because it was the first gene therapy for a non-lethal disease. So gene therapy was developed for lethal diseases or diseases where there's no therapy, and so we were the first to move into the clinic for a non-lethal disease. And I think in the future there'll be a number of different applications for gene therapy in the arena of non-lethal diseases, or not even diseases, just actually conditions. And then I'd like to close, if I go quickly enough and so we don't run over, to discuss in a few slides where I see the field of gene therapy going. And I actually think that the class is half full, not half empty at this point. And I think many of you who go on into medicine or into research will be using gene therapy approaches in the clinic, gene therapy tools in the laboratory, and this will become really accepted practice for the treatment of a number of different conditions. So what is gene therapy? So when I started in gene therapy, I actually started as a postdoc at MIT many years ago. Gene therapy was thought to be the treatment of a genetic disease by delivery of that normal gene into cells that have that genetic defect. And so for muscular dystrophy, which is a genetic disease conferred by loss of a gene called dystrophin, or cystic fibrosis, which is due to a loss of a gene called CFTR, the thought was you would put that gene back into the tissue where it's defective. And that's how gene therapy was considered. But gene therapy is now expanded into other areas. It's used actually in the area of vaccinations, in the area of treating non-genetic diseases. And so the way I view gene therapy is that it's now the prevention or treatment of disease by the intracellular delivery of nucleic acid. So you don't have to even deliver a gene. You can deliver small RNAs or DNAs that can regulate gene expression in ways that are therapeutic. And I'll allude to that in a few slides. So gene therapy, as I said, started with genetic diseases. I think all the original pioneers in this field were focused on treating diseases such as hemophilia, muscular dystrophy, cystic fibrosis. But unfortunately, the concept of treating diseases was much more difficult than expected. So cystic fibrosis is a disease where you have a mutation in the gene that affects chloride conductance in lung cells. And so to treat this disease, you have to deliver a gene to all lung cells. And that may sound easy in concept, but how do you deliver a gene to all cells in the lung effectively? You probably have to get 10 to 20% of the cells in the lung modified to correct the disease. For muscular dystrophy, you have to treat all skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, and maybe even other tissues with the wild-type gene. And this is a very difficult task. The number of muscle cells in the body is much greater than we can actually make vectors to deliver the gene to those cells. And so this turned out to be a very difficult task. But there are certain cases where this has worked, and I'll tell you at the end, is that the cases where it's worked is where we're actually targeting the stem cell. If you can modify a single stem cell that then can repopulate the tissue, such as the hematopoietic system, that will allow for successful gene therapy. And so gene therapy will become closely aligned with stem cell therapy in the future because we have to develop therapies to treat patients with genetic disease, and so we have to do that by correcting the defect in the stem cells. So where I started to work in this field was actually treating acquired diseases. And where many people focused initially was in cancer, and especially in patients that have terminal disease that failed all conventional therapies. Gene therapy was thought to be kind of the new frontier of therapies. Unfortunately, it's been difficult to treat cancer because of the fact that the cancer cells are evolved to evade the immune system or evade therapeutic approaches. But we've also shown it can work in arthritis, as I'll talk about at the end, and in diabetes. Where I think gene therapy is going to work most effectively in the future is actually treating not really diseases, but disorders. And these are actually conditions where you want to improve upon a natural process. So if you're 70 years old and you're skiing in Colorado and you break a bone, that bone doesn't heal as well because the stem cells in your body are more defective. And so you could use gene therapy to deliver genes to the site of the fracture to promote that natural healing process. So again, it's a non-lethal condition. It's a natural process. We can just use gene transfer to enhance that process. Where gene therapy is actually well-suited is in the context of transplantation, because you take tissue out of a donor, you can modify it in culture and transplant it back into the patient. And so you can use gene transfer to treat conditions, but also to modify the tissues and cells so the body's immune system doesn't recognize them as foreign. So you might be able to induce tolerance to the tissues by using gene transfer. Gene therapy has been applied to infectious diseases, both prophylactically as well as therapeutically. I think that trying to treat HIV would be very difficult because of the ways of using gene therapy require sophisticated technology that aren't useful in the third world country or not applicable in third world countries. However, we might be able to develop vaccines based on gene transfer that could be useful in third world countries. And in that regard, we could do HIV vaccines. We could also immunize against bacterial infections. And you might be able to immunize against cancer because there are known tumor antigens that that appear to be immunogenic if delivered in the right milieu. So, what type of therapeutic agents can you deliver by gene transfer? Originally, the thought was you would deliver genes encoding proteins that actually are enzymes or factors that work intracellularly. But again, given the fact that these proteins work intracellularly, the number of cells you have to modify to get a therapeutic effect is extremely large. And so where gene therapy has worked is where you can deliver genes encoding secreted proteins. So this is for a certain set of diseases that are due to deficiencies in cytokines or growth factors or clotting factors. And so a few cells can be modified to express a large amount of a secreted protein. So you can make a small site in the body make a lot of a soluble factor that's taken up in the bloodstream and then can have systemic effects. However, you don't have to necessarily deliver a gene. There's a lot of technology that's been developed where you deliver actually small fragments of DNA or RNA to cells. And this can be antisense, either RNA or DNA, ribozymes, or the new technology is siRNA. And a number of drug companies are developing small RNAs that target oncogenes, viral genes, or mutant genes. You can actually downregulate these using this technology. And I don't want to go into much detail about this. I just want to highlight this once without going into the mechanism too much, but highlight it because I think in the next 10 years, the number of therapies that are developed using small RNAs or siRNAs that can be delivered to cells and shown to form complexes that can target specific RNA transcripts to either degrade them or silence them for translation, I think this area is going to be one of the most rapidly developed areas of gene therapy. However, what's interesting is the FDA doesn't call this gene therapy. The FDA calls these small RNA molecules small molecule drugs. And so they're regulated differently. But I would argue that delivering RNA to cells that downregulate oncogenes or viral genes is a form of gene therapy. It's just the FDA at this point doesn't consider it as such. So what are the advantages of gene therapy? This is kind of your hypothetical list of why we think gene therapy is a good idea. This is what you put in your grant when you're writing a grant proposal to NIH to say, why should you give me money? It's because for many diseases, gene therapy represents the only therapeutic option. So for severe combined immunodeficiency, muscular dystrophy, other diseases, there's no therapy. You can treat the disease, extend lifespan a year or two, but there is no cure. And I don't think there will be a cure unless we develop an effective gene therapy. Unlike conventional therapies, gene therapy can actually cure a disease. If you could actually deliver a gene to cells, or a number of cells, it has the potential to cure a disease, unlike conventional drug therapy. The therapeutic agent is a gene, so thousands of potentially therapeutic genes exist. Every week you read about a new gene that's been identified, playing a role in human disease, and so we can now deliver these genes using the same methods that treat a wide variety of different diseases. We also can use targeted delivery of the gene. So we can deliver the gene to specific sites in the body to bypass systemic toxicity. And in theory, you can get long-term, I say delivery here, I should say long-term expression of the therapeutic gene. So in theory, and this is only in theory, you only have to give one dose of the gene therapy, and that should have a long-term therapeutic effect. So you can target delivery, get long-term effects. The therapeutic agent is a gene, which is the natural product. And for many diseases, it represents really the only therapeutic option. And the long-term goal is that we'd like to be able to deliver genes at sites that we can regulate their expression by either using drugs or by the disease pathology itself. And so if you have an inflammatory disease, you might be able to regulate expression of the gene by the level of inflammation. And so forth, then the therapy is self-regulating by disease pathology. So for any gene therapy, any approach you can think of, or any type of disease target, there's only two types of gene therapy approaches you can use. I call these ex vivo and in vivo. And ex vivo is a simple procedure. It involves removing cells from the patient and then modifying the cells in culture by gene transfer, and I'll show you how we do that in a few slides. So ex vivo involves removing cells. You can then select or modify the cells further and inject the cells back in. So ex vivo gene therapy involves modifying cells in culture to now express the therapeutic gene. This has certain advantages because you know what cells are being modified, you know what you're putting back in. However, drug companies don't like this because this is an expensive procedure because you have to grow cells in culture, characterize the cells, and inject them back in. So what drug companies want to do is they want to do in vivo gene therapy, where the gene transfer occurs in vivo. So you inject the vector carrying the therapeutic gene into the body, into a tumor, into a muscle, into the bloodstream, so the gene transfer actually occurs in vivo. This would be obviously much cheaper. This could be an off-the-shelf product. However, you can't regulate necessarily where the gene goes when you inject into the body. And so the FDA has concerns about using this approach because of the fact you can't control what happens after you inject it. So how do we get genes in the cells? And the way we do that is we use vectors. And a vector is any agent that can enhance the uptake of therapeutic nucleic acid in the cells. And there are two types of vectors, general types of vectors, either viral or non-viral based. Viruses are probably the most efficient, but there's a potential of disease because viruses can cause disease and cause immune responses. But viruses, so they're more effective, we think in the long run probably the way we'd like to deliver genes. Non-viral based methods are less effective, but potentially safer. And the virus people are working with the non-viral people, and we'll probably come up with hybrid systems that will allow gene transfer. And so one example of a virus, and I'll show you a few more of this, this is actually using a virus that causes the common cold, or an adenovirus. Not a rhinovirus, but the adenovirus that causes a different type of cold. And we can actually modify adenoviruses to carry therapeutic genes that will now deliver those genes into cells when the virus infects it. Or we can take naked DNA, and we can isolate this from bacteria in the laboratory, couple it with different ligands, condense it, and cells will actually endocytose the DNA and take it up into the cell. However, this is an inefficient process, and the DNA eventually is degraded, or the majority of it is, so the amount of the therapeutic gene which is expressed is relatively low. So what type of vectors are worked on, or what type of vectors can we use? The one that's used extensively are retroviruses, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in a moment. A type of retrovirus is actually a lentivirus. And the best-known lentivirus for people in this room is HIV. So HIV is something that you don't want to get, you don't want to expose yourself to. However, as I will show you, we can modify these viruses so that they're non-pathogenic, and they can be used now for delivery of genes into cells without causing disease. At least that's the concept. And there's several clinical trials I'll allude to have used lentiviruses successfully to treat human disease. And I'll talk about those at the end. Adenovirus, as I just showed you, can be used. Herpes simplex virus, something, again, we try to avoid, but here it can be modified to deliver genes into cells. A virus that is now really the darling of the gene therapy field. It's a very small virus. It's actually a contaminant of adenovirus preps. It requires adenovirus to grow, but it's very effective for gene delivery. Vaccinovirus has been used for vaccines for a long period of time, and in some ways that's a gene therapy vector. We can deliver antigens to immunize against viral infection or bacterial infection using vaccinovirus. And so, example, this is what an AAV virus looks like, a retrovirus, an adenovirus that has these fibers extruding from it, and an HSV virus. And these vectors, which I'll show you how we do this in a moment, can be modified to deliver therapeutic genes efficiently the different cell types. For non-viral approaches, you can just take naked DNA that you can isolate in the laboratory. Cells will, at some low frequency, take that up. We can couple it with fat particles, so cells take up the fat particles effectively and take up the DNA. You can link it to polymers. You can actually use electroporation. In fact, I was a consultant for a company that was using electroporation to deliver DNA to human muscle, and they would put two electrodes around the site of injection and give a low dose of electrical volt that seems to increase the efficiency of the DNA to get across the cell membrane and into the cell. And so it was very effective, and so this is currently being used clinically because of the fact electroporation enhances DNA uptake. And interestingly, actually sound waves can do this, but not as efficiently as electrical pulses. So what I want to do is give you a few slides, and this is probably more background than you would want about how we actually can develop a virus that causes disease pathology, how we can take that and make it a safe vector for gene transfer. And so the example I'm going to give, two examples, are retroviral vectors and then show you briefly adenovirus before going on and showing you how we can apply these in the clinic. So retroviral vectors were really the workhorse of the gene therapy field. And they were based on a murine, or mouse virus, a mouse leukemia virus. So obviously it's a mouse virus that can cause cancer in mice under certain conditions. And the thought was if you use the mouse virus, the chance of it recombining with a human virus and creating a new chimeric virus that may have altered pathology, the thought was if you use the murine one, that chance was eliminated. Whether that was required or not is unclear, but the FDA required gene therapies groups to use non-human viruses initially. The advantage of retroviruses is that they actually replicate, and they part of their life cycle involves the virus integrating into the host DNA. So if you're infected with this virus, the cell that's infected actually has within this chromosome this virus integrated. So it means for the life of that cell, that virus carries that, or that cell carries that gene. So HIV is a retrovirus, so it infects a CD4-positive cell. That cell is modified for life. But the advantage of this is if you can deliver a gene to cells so it stably integrates, it will now express that therapeutic gene for the life of the cell and also express it in all daughter cells that come from that cell when it divides. The virus requires only a few proteins for replication, so it's a very simple virus. And as I'll show you, the ways that we can grow this virus and make it replicate, you can actually grow a replication defective virus. So how can a virus be defective in replication and still grow it? And I'll show you how we do that on the next slide. So this is the retroviral life cycle, very complicated. The only thing I want to emphasize is that one part of the life cycle, as I just said, involves the virus integrating into the host DNA. So when it integrates into the host DNA, it's there for the life of the cell. So it's a stable way of introducing a gene into a cell. And so if you integrate stably into the host DNA, the integrated gene is present in all daughter cells. So any cells that divide from the infected cell carry a copy of this gene. And so the advantage would be if this was a hematopoietic stem cell, all cells that are derived from it will carry the therapeutic gene. And as I'll show you at the end, modifying a single hematopoietic stem cell can result in 10 to the 10th hematopoietic cells all carrying a retroviral vector expressing the therapeutic gene. And that has been used successfully in the clinic to treat a number of diseases. Other viruses, like adenoviruses or non-viral vectors, don't integrate. So when cells divide, the DNA is lost because it's not integrated into the host DNA. And just as the cells divide, eventually that DNA is lost. So this can give you stable expression. These viruses can give you transient, unstable gene expression. So how do we make a replication-defective virus? It's actually very simple. It looks complicated. But what you see here on the top is actually the viral structure. And this could be a murine virus. It could actually be an HIV vector or virus. It contains three viral proteins. If you delete the genes for these proteins and insert your therapeutic gene, you now have a vector that potentially can grow but doesn't have the viral proteins present in order to make the infectious virus. So what we do is we generate a cell line that expresses three viral proteins. We can make a cell line. And this is a cell with a nucleus as shown here that we can grow in culture. And this cell can now be engineered to make the three viral proteins. So if we introduce our vector into the cell, it will now actually release infectious virus particles. That when it infects a target cell, this vector will go in, integrate into the host DNA, but now can't replicate because the viral proteins aren't present. So it's a very simple concept. We make the virus replication defective, but we grow it in the laboratory by providing the proteins it needs for replication in the complementing cell line. We can make virus at high titer that then infects a target cell, but it can't replicate further. And so this virus is safe because it can no longer replicate. It's stably integrated into the target cell. and all daughter cells will now carry that virus. Very simple concept. It took a number of years to optimize this, but again, a very simple concept that's used for all other vectors. So the advantages to using retroviruses are that it's been used extensively in clinical trials. As I'll show you, it's been used in a number of clinical studies, and the fact that it stably integrates and is maintained in the target cell. What I won't go into is that it only appears to work well if you infect dividing cells. So this is actually a disadvantage because it infects only dividing cells in culture. So you can't use this virus in vivo to infect muscle, liver, spleen, or other cells because it only infects dividing cells. We can't grow high titers of it, but using it ex vivo, it's efficient enough to infect the cells in culture. But the problem is, and this is what I'm alluding to at the end, is this virus integrates into the host DNA. And by the fact that it integrates into the host DNA, it runs a risk of actually mutagenizing the host. So where it goes into the chromosome, it can cause a mutation. And depending where it goes in and what it's doing, it actually can induce mutations of a tumor suppressor gene or activate expression of a gene that can cause cancer. And so there is a hypothetical risk that this virus can cause cancer. You know, it's a hypothetical risk, but there is a report of three individuals in France that were in the gene therapy trial that developed cancer because of where the virus was integrated. And I'll allude to that in a few slides. Another type of virus, and I showed you this earlier, is an adenovirus that, again, has these fibers on the surface of it. It's, a fairly simple virus, but more complicated than retroviruses. It has a number of different genes, E1A, E1B, these other E1 or E2 or E3 or E4 genes. But what's important about this is the genes at the end of the virus are required for this virus to grow. So if you take this virus and you now get rid of these genes at this part of the virus and insert your therapeutic gene, this virus is now replication defective. It can't grow unless you grow it in the cell line that has E1A or E1B present. So we can complement this virus in the laboratory. We can grow this virus to very high titers and use this for delivery of the therapeutic gene in the variety of tissues in vivo. However, this virus doesn't integrate, and so expression is lost over time. So it's useful for certain applications, but not others. I think I'm going to skip over this. So just to summarize what I've showed you, for ex vivo gene therapy, we think retroviruses and lentiviruses involving infection of dividing cells in culture are the vectors of choice. And these are viruses we can grow in the laboratory and generate them so they're replication defective, but we actually can grow them to high titer, where they now will target the cells, stably infect them, and these cells can be injected back in. If you want to deliver viruses in vivo, we can only use certain types of viruses, such as adenoviruses or AAV, herpes simplex virus, that can infect non-dividing cells. And so this can be used to infect muscle or liver or spleen or brain or other targets by direct injection. But again, we have really no way of targeting infection because it's only really targeted by where the needle goes in and where the virus is actually injected. So that's my kind of overview or introduction, I should say, to gene therapy. I hope it wasn't too laden down with virology. What I'd like to do now is actually give you some examples of how gene therapy has actually been used successfully. So it was in the introduction by Sherry, she referred to a trial that was started in 1990. And this was performed by Michael Blaise and French Anderson. They treated two patients that actually had a disease called ADA deficiency, which is the type of severe combined immunodeficiency. So these patients have no immune system. They can't go to school. They can't go out in public. You know, if they're exposed to different viruses, they actually come down with disease and eventually die sometime late childhood, or depending upon the type of deficiency, sometimes very early on. And what was done by Michael Blaise and French Anderson was actually to take the T cells, which are the cells that are really deficient in this disease, modify the T cells in culture with the virus expressing the gene, this gene ADA, and infuse the cells back into the patients. And this was a short-term therapy because the T cells have a finite lifespan and eventually die off. And so what was wanted to develop was an approach where we actually could develop a cure for this disease using a different approach, which I'll summarize in a second. Another disease which just appeared in Science is adrenoleukodystrophy. This is a demyelinating disease, and it was shown in several patients treated that there's an improvement in their brain function and the rate of demyelination. So it suggests that we can treat brain diseases using gene therapy approaches. Beta thalassemia, there was a report in Science just recently again that treating beta thalassemia with gene therapy with fairly remarkable results. And a disease called Leber's congenital amaurosis, which is a genetic eye disease. This actually has gotten the most publicity recently because there was a dog with this disease that was a blind that then was allowed to see after gene transfer. The dog went to Congress, petitioned Congress to allow these gene therapy trials to go forward. There are a lot of pictures in the press about the dog going to Congress. But they've now done several trials with amazing results. The patients that couldn't see or were colorblind now can see or can see with color. Fairly remarkable results. And then another type of severe combined immune deficiency, this is actually a more severe disease, X-linked SCID. There are several reports of successful therapy. So I'm going to talk about ADA deficiency, talk about X-linked SCID as examples of successful gene therapy, talk a little bit about what I've done with rheumatoid arthritis, emphasizing the fact this was the first non-lethal gene therapy trial that was performed. But I'd like to highlight that the trials that really have shown the best effect, they've actually all involved targeting a hematopoietic stem cell. So again, a single cell that can repopulate all the cells in the hematopoietic system, that if you can target the cell by gene transfer, you can treat these types of diseases, of which there's a large number. These other diseases, rheumatoid arthritis, which we've worked on, and Leber's congenital amaurosis, are ones where there's a defined site, either the joint space, which we've done for arthritis, or the eye space, which seems to be an immune privilege site where you get very effective gene transfer. And just to point out, these two trials, adrenoleukodystrophy and beta thalassemia, actually have used HIV-based vectors. So this is taking a virus that nobody would want to get, modifying to make it safe, as I showed you how we can do that, and using it for gene transfer. Because lentiviruses seem to target the hematopoietic stem cell more effectively than conventional retroviral vectors. So just to highlight what I've alluded to several times, I think one of the best targets for gene therapy is when you target an adult stem cell population that can contribute to all lineages. And so the point of this slide is that a single cell can actually give rise to all hematopoietic cell types, T cells, B cells, mast cells, macrophages, erythrocytes, platelets, etc. And the stem cell can undergo self-renewal, by definition, making it a stem cell. So the goal for many gene therapists has been to modify this cell, engraft this back into patients that have had bone marrow ablation, allowing that stem cell to repopulate all hematopoietic lineages, giving rise to functional cells. And this now has been done in a number of clinical studies with tremendous therapeutic efficacy. There is no way we can modify all the cells, but if you can modify a stem cell, all it takes is modifying a single cell that can then allow for repopulation of all tissues or all hematopoietic tissues. And this just gives you some idea of the types of diseases that could be treated, immunodeficiency disorders, Fanconi anemia, hemoglobinopathies, lysosomal storage disorders, mucopolysaccharidoses, even making bone marrow cells more resistant to drug treatment strategies for cancer, and even, as been reported recently, for treating AIDS by modifying the stem cell to make it resistant to infection by HIV and then preventing infection of all cells which are derived from that stem cell, making all cells in your bone marrow system resistant to HIV infection. So the disease, the one I'm going to talk about, is adenosine deaminase deficiency. And this is an enzyme involved in deaminating adenosine into inosine, which is part of the purine salvage pathway. But the important point about this is that if you lose this enzyme, you increase the level of certain toxic metabolites. So you see pathologies in a variety of different tissues due to the fact that these metabolites go up in the bloodstream. But the cell types that are most sensitive to these metabolites are actually T cells and NK cells. So these patients, although they have abnormalities in a variety of different tissues, they have no functional immune system because they have no T cells. in no NK cells. And so the thought was that if you could modify the stem cell now to express the gene for ADA, you could treat this disease. And so what was done, and this was a trial that was conducted very successfully in Italy several years ago, was to develop a regimen where you could take a child, in many cases this disease, they were treating kids 2 or 3, 4 years of age, actually develop a regimen that did not involve giving them high dose of radiation to make space for this bone marrow transplant, but give them kind of a low-dose toxic compound, busulfan, that was able to kill some but not all of the hematopoietic cells and bone marrow cells. They also isolated, before the busulfan treatment, bone marrow cells, isolated from these the hematopoietic stem cells, and then introduced into them this vector carrying the gene for ADA. Then they infused the cells back into the patient, and they waited. And what was observed was these patients have no T cells. So they're deficient in T cells. So if you have no T cells, you can't respond to any viral infection. And one of the best assays for this is you can actually do a tetanus vaccination, use tetanus toxin, which we've all received tetanus vaccinations, to see if they elicit an immune response to that. But what's shown here is that all these patients now have elevated T cells. And all of these patients, even this patient that have lower levels, all went from basically a bubble to go back to school. So all of these patients had a complete change in lifestyle. They also gained weight. They also showed improvement in all pathologies that observed with this disease. Extremely remarkable. In all the patients, and this was showing that for 6, they now have done 18, and this is now approved for general treatment in Italy and soon all of Europe. And this just shows, to summarize, that basically that you see long-term engraftment of these cells so that all cells derived from a stem cell now carry this red bar reflects the retrovirus. All cells that are derived from the hematopoietic stem cell carry the retrovirus and now have, at least the T and NK cells, have improved function. And the important point here is the treatment that's used for this disease is actually taking the protein and coupling it to a complex called PEG, or polyethylene glycol, that allows T cells to take up the protein at some low level. They've now weaned these kids off this treatment, and they're completely functional. And so this has been hailed as a remarkable success. So that was a success. I'm going to give you kind of a slightly different story. I'd say it's a success, but you can see what some of the concerns are about gene therapy. So this is a different type of severe combined immunodeficiency. It's X-linked, so it's on the X chromosome. And it involves a mutation in the gene for the IL-2 receptor gamma chain. And I know most people here aren't immunologists, but this receptor is actually a shared receptor for a number of cytokines that are important for development of the immune system, IL-2, IL-4, IL-7, IL-9, IL-21, IL-15. So if you're missing this receptor, cells can't respond to any of the cytokines that stimulate immune function. In fact, these individuals have no immune cells. They're actually worse than the ADA-deficient individuals. And so many patients with this disease die 5 or 6, 7 years of age. Very severe disease. And so what was done was a very similar approach, which I just showed you. They put into a retroviral vector the gene for this common chain of the IL-2 receptor, and they introduced this back into basically autologous bone marrow. Now, just as an aside, this virus is the vector I developed when I was a postdoc. And so it boasts, as I will show you, very effective, but also has some drawbacks. And so, but this was something that I developed many years ago that's now really been the workhorse of the gene therapy community. So this paper came out, again, in Science. This was hailed as a success. It says gene therapy of human severe combined immunodeficiency, SCID X1 disease or X-linked disease. The patients that were treated all show remarkable recovery and a fully functional immune system. The problem is this paper came out the year later. So they've treated now 18 children. I think that it may be more now. And 2, and then the third child developed leukemia. So 3 out of 18 developed leukemia. All 18 had improved functional immune system. So the gene therapy worked, but 3 of the kids developed disease. And And the question was, why did they develop disease? And what the gene therapy community did is they actually kind of came together and put an enormous effort into trying to study what happened in those three patients. And what they showed was, is in all three patients, the retrovirus, and this is actually supposed to demark the retroviral vector, it integrated into a specific spot or a specific region that was actually close to another gene called LMO2. So when this virus integrates into the host DNA, it does so fairly randomly. But what it means is that if you infect a million cells in culture, one out of those million cells might have this virus integrating just randomly next to this gene LMO2. And so the three patients that came down with cancer all had this virus integrating next to this LMO2 gene, suggesting that this site for this virus integrating can give rise to leukemia at a higher rate. And so what was shown, and this is a poor schematic of what I think is was shown by a number of labs at Transpire. So these are basically the number of cells that went back into the patient. Each of these bars reflects a retrovirus that has infected the cell, but they've all infected different locations. They've all gone into and stayed integrated to the host DNA at different sites. But this cell, actually the virus integrated next to this gene, LMO2. And this integration event allowed this cell a selective advantage. So this cell proliferated faster and proliferated faster, and at some frequency, one of these cells became cancerous. So what we know is that this insertion next to this gene appeared to drive cancer. The gene that was inserted into that site, this IL-2 receptor common chain, also was important for driving cancer, because that was not seen in the ADA trial, which I just said was a success. So here we have three patients that came down with cancer. Two of the patients were treated with chemotherapy and are actually healthy. A third one died, but I think a complication of immune infection, not from the cancer. And so the FDA, as well as the European agencies, have allowed these trials to go forward because of how effective they were. And gene therapists are now trying to devise strategies to eliminate these three patients, or whatever the number is going to be, that come down with leukemia. And so it's an interesting observation. It's an unfortunate observation. But the fact that 15 patients responded well and have normal immune function, this trial also was hailed as a success. So I'm going to change gears slightly. I'm not going to try to say this is a successful gene therapy, but I want to actually talk a little bit about what my lab does, show a little bit about what we're trying to do. And this is something which is still continuing and which I think has really set the stage for treating non-lethal diseases by gene transfer. And so what my lab has focused on over the years is ways to treat diseases that affect the joint space. And this could be rheumatoid arthritis, this could be osteoarthritis, this could be sports injuries. You can have cartilage defects. A variety of things can happen to the joints. You can have effects on tendons and ligaments. And the thought is that we could treat that very effectively by delivering genes into the joint space. And so we can do this in vivo easily by injecting the vector directly into the joint space. And we can do this, as I've talked about, with a number of different vector systems. And if you do this with a variety of vectors, if you deliver a gene that turns cells, in this case, black, this is actually the lining of the joint space of a rabbit. And you can see that we can modify many of the cells that line the joint to express a transgene that can be detected, in this case, as alkaline phosphatase. So very efficient gene transfer process. We also can do this ex vivo, where we can take these cells that line the joint out of the patient, grow them in culture, expand them, test them, inject them back into the joint space. And so if we do this with cells that are modified to express a fluorescent green gene, so these cells are all green, this is actually from a knee joint that receives cells modified in culture to express a gene that turns cells green under a certain wavelength of a fluorescent microscope. So again, very effective modification and integration of these cells into the joint. And so what we showed, and this is one of the slides where you can show four or five postdocs' efforts on one slide, but I'll do that here for the sake of time. What we did is we actually chose as our therapeutic gene, without going into the pathology of the disease, we chose a protein that blocks the activity of an inflammatory agent, IL-1 or interleukin-1. And this is a very effective inhibitor of IL-1, and IL-1 is thought to drive many of the pathologies associated with rheumatoid arthritis. And so we've showed that if you inject cells into the joint that have been modified to express this inhibitor, we can block pathologies associated with disease in animal models of arthritis, in the mouse, in the rat, in the rabbit, and even in the horse. And importantly, this procedure was safe with no adverse effects. In fact, we had to do this in a large number of animals to prove it was safe before we went forward into the clinic. And so many years ago, we proposed, spent years getting approval, and then went forward with the first gene therapy for a non-lethal disease. And so this trial was designed to emphasize safety and not efficacy. They said, you have to feel comfortable treating your grandmother with this approach. So the way we designed this was actually identifying grandmothers that needed joint replacement surgery. So they actually needed their knuckle joints replaced because their rheumatoid arthritis was so severe. And so we were able to isolate cells from the joint prior to this replacement, grow the cells in culture, modify the cells with our retrovirus expressing this inhibitor of IL-1, inject the cells back into the knuckle joint, and then 1 week later, these joints are replaced as part of regularly scheduled knuckle replacement surgery. So there was no therapeutic benefit because of the fact that the virus was only in there for a week. But it gave us a source of tissue to look and see if we got gene transfer. And this actually turns out this was the control, because two joints got controls and two joints got modified cells. This actually was a control joint, but it was the first joint injected, we thought, with bona fide cells. The other joints were also treated. Very simple procedure. And then 1 week later, we were able to get the joint tissue back out and using a procedure to detect the presence of the virus, actually the presence of expression of the viral gene, we could show that the joints that received the modified cells, showing reflected here as T for transgene versus control, that all the joints that received the modified cells expressed the transgene. And so again, this was the first gene therapy for non-lethal disease, and all patients showed no evidence of any adverse pathology, which at the time we thought was very good. In fact, every one of these patients we took out for dinner and wine afterwards, no adverse effects as far as we could tell. We've had to monitor these patients every year for the last 10 years, and there's been no adverse effects, although it was an older population, so several have passed away. They actually had to do analysis of different tissue samples on these patients to prove that the reasons why they passed was not due to a retroviral infection, but there was no evidence of any retrovirus anywhere in these patients. They were all in their 70s or 80s when they were first treated. So overall, the safety for this was extremely impressive. A second trial was also started, and this trial was designed where the joint space or the joint was left in for 1 month. So a very similar trial, but here we were treating the joints, and we actually could start assessing efficacy. Unfortunately, as I told you, the three patients in the X-linked SCID trial that developed leukemia, when this leukemia was identified, all gene therapy trials were halted, especially gene therapy trials involving retroviral vectors. So we only were able to do two patients in this protocol. We couldn't do the six that were scheduled. But what was interesting was if you measure in these patients, the pain score and swelling in the joints that received the modified cells versus control cells, the patient who was blinded to this, as was the doctor who took the scores, there was no pain in the treated joints, but no effect on pain in the untreated joints. And if you looked at swelling, there was a reduction, a significant reduction in the swelling in the treated joints compared to the untreated joints. So small number, not significant, but it was the right trend. And so this has kind of allowed us and motivated us to continue these studies because of the efficacy that was seen or suggested by these two trials. So what we proved was is we can put genes into a human joint. It seems to be safe and very feasible. We get expression. It's well tolerated. Suggestion of therapeutic effects and further trials are warranted. However, we think we really need a way of delivering genes directly to the joint space itself. And so where we're going, and I'm going to skip over this, except to allude to the fact that we're actually switching to a different virus that works well in vivo. This is the adeno-associated virus that we've shown can infect human synovial cells or cells from joints very effectively, at least certain types can, in culture. And what we've done now is we've actually switched to a model of disease that actually may be more clinically useful. And what we've now done is we've started to collaborate with people that treat racehorses because of the need for new therapies for racehorses that 95% develop inflammatory conditions. And so we're now using horses to try to see if we can get long-term expression and therapeutic benefit, and actually trying to see if we can develop a product that could be used to treat racehorses. It's really the first step towards developing the therapy for human disease. And so what we've shown is that if we inject the right vector into the joint space, we can see very high levels of expression of a therapeutic gene. And we've shown in horse models that this is effective at blocking equine osteoarthritis. And I'd like to point out now that these horses are not euthanized at the end of this. They're actually just put up to pasture. So a number of these horses that were treated, if you go to Gainesville, Florida, you can see them out in the pasture. People ride these horses. So these are not horses which are anything is done to them. And so actually, this now is being tested in client horses to see if this is an effective treatment for treating conditions such as osteoarthritis, which develop with extensive overtraining. And so based on that data, we are close, although not quite yet started, to do the same thing in human patients. We're trying to treat osteoarthritis, of which there is no effective therapy for this condition, by delivering the gene expressing this inhibitor of IL-1 into human osteoarthritic joints. So what I want to do is spend just the last 2, 3, 4 minutes kind of giving you my view of where the field's going. I've tried to give you an introduction to what gene therapy is, examples that it's effective at treating human disease, some limitations, showing that we can start to treat non-lethal diseases. So I'd like to give you some idea of where I think the field is going. So what's been the progress in gene therapy? Clearly, we've demonstrated efficacy in animal models of acquired and genetic diseases. The number of diseases that have shown the ability to be treated by gene therapy, at least in animal models, is mind-boggling. There are multiple journals where there's 10 papers, 20 papers a week showing efficacy. As I said, wide number of diseases and disorders which are applicable to treatment by gene therapy. Feasibility has been shown in the clinical setting for both acquired and genetic diseases. There's been efficacy. In this slide, I should now say there are phase 3 trials, especially in Europe, have shown efficacy for treating these diseases by gene transfer. And clearly, gene therapy is safe, although you can argue that a few of these cases suggest that it's not completely safe. So what do we need in gene therapy field? One of the things that we've really realized we're missing is we have no good animal models of human disease. We have models of disease, but they really don't mimic the human disease. So we really don't know the best time to intervene or where to intervene or how to intervene to treat human disease because the animal models don't mimic the condition. So we think we need better animal models of human disease to optimize the gene therapy. We definitely need better gene transfer vectors. In fact, everybody says at meetings, what we have to emphasize is vectors, 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 and immune response, immune response, immune response. Because the immune response to the virus or to the transgene has been really limiting gene therapy. I would argue that we need a better understanding of stem cell biology because these are really the best targets for gene transfer, given the fact they can repopulate different tissues, such as the hematopoietic system, but also liver, spleen, kidney, brain, if we can get the right stem cells. And then we have to identify what patients are the perfect candidates for a more risky or more aggressive type of treatment. So we want to know what patients are going to be the most severely affected versus those who are only minor affected, and know what patients we should be treating and to be able to treat them earlier. So where will we be in the next decade? And the joke here is I've made this slide up last decade, but I keep using it and recycling it, but I think eventually I'll be correct. In the next decade, that gene therapy will be an approved form of treatment for many types of human diseases. It actually is approved in Europe now for ADA deficiency. And the therapy will be designed to match the genetic profile of the patient. So maybe this won't be the next decade, but at least in the next 20 years, I think this will be true. I think the greatest advancements in the next 10 years will be for acquired diseases and disorders. And we don't actually have to use gene therapy as a sole treatment. I think for cancer and other conditions, it's going to be used in conjunction with standard therapy. So I think combination therapies involving the gene therapy, drugs, a variety of other biologics, will make it more effective. I think most of the successful approaches will involve the use of genetically modified stem cells. So if you make an iPS cell from a patient with a certain disease, those cells are defective. So you have to modify those cells before you can use them clinically to treat that disease. And then, of course, the number of diseases demonstrated to be amenable to treatment by gene therapy will significantly increase. And so, like I said, every week there's a new disease identified with the gene that's involved in that disease characterized and the mechanism of its role in disease determined. So having gone through that, hopefully I haven't bored you too much about gene therapy. Unfortunately, it involves a little virology, a little animal models, as well as clinical applications. But I'd just like to acknowledge, this is my list of the people that have worked in my lab over the years. This is just to show there's a large number of people that have been involved in these studies, everybody contributing in their own way. The people that contributed mostly to the work I presented today, at least from my lab, were Sun-Yi Kim, Eric Leckman, Steve Givazani, and Jibao Mi. And the picture, and I'm not sure if this is one I can show in public. I use it, but I keep thinking there's something in here that's not correct to show in public. But this is a picture that was put together for one of our gene therapy lab group meetings. I'm not even sure who's in this picture, but I've always liked it. And every time I look at it, I see something new. So I think I'll show it quickly and get it off the screen. And having said that, I'll stop and be willing to discuss any aspects of this or any other areas that were not covered in this lecture. So thank you.
We will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please raise your hand, and one of us will bring the microphone to you. And can the house please bring up the lights? Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. I would like to ask for a little more about the political, the policy, the legal framework that will be necessary to help advance your scientific efforts here, particularly in the United States, because you mentioned a lot about regulations and finally getting a little acceptance legally in Europe. But in order to get that in the next decade or the next couple decades, what can we as future policymakers do to try to get more acceptance, especially given negative reactions to stem cells?
Yeah. So I think the one thing I just want to point out that the stem cell work we're talking about is these are not embryonic stem cells. So bone marrow transplant is highly accepted. I mean, it's used in a large number of patients. There's no ethical considerations there. I think the ethical considerations with gene therapy stem from the fact that we don't yet know what the long-term effects of that gene transfer. So I referred to the three individuals that came down with leukemia. Many of you may have heard about an individual at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia that received an adenoviral vector for a liver disease and died. And so between that patient, Jesse Gelsinger, and the three patients in France, there's been this concern that if you give a gene transfer, it can give you a long-term therapeutic effect. But what if 10 years down the road, all these patients start coming down with leukemia? So the FDA is really trying to look at this by the risk-benefit. So for those diseases where there's really no treatment, they're willing to take a higher risk. For arthritis or type 1 diabetes or other diseases, it's more of an ethical concern. You know, is it willing to take a risk? What is the risk? How do we assess the risk? How long do we have to monitor the patients for? So I think those are the issues. I don't really think there's anything that's too ethically wrong with these trials. It's more, what's the long-term effect going to be? And it's really hard to assess that. So the policy the FDA has, you have to follow up on these patients for 17 years. So you have to take blood samples. You have to monitor and make sure they've become viremic. You have to make sure they're not showing any adverse effects due to the gene therapy. And I have to say for other treatments, this is not, or other drugs, whether it's antibody therapies or biologic therapies, they don't require that. And the reason why is because they're just acute treatments that you can stop the protein or stop the drug. Gene therapy, once you give it, those cells are there. And so one thing, I don't know if I brought this out, but all the trials that have targeted hematopoietic stem cell that have been successful, except for the ADA trial, there's been expansion of a clone that has a specific viral integration. So in the thalassemia trial, in the adrenal leukodystrophy trial, the X-linked SCID trials, there's been a proliferation of a specific clone. These people haven't come down with leukemia, but there's been expansion of a cell population that contains a specific viral integrant because of where it integrates into the host DNA. So the concern is, what if 10 years from now, one of the cells becomes cancerous? And so it's that risk-benefit. And so for arthritis, where there are drugs, they don't halt disease, but they make people feel better, should we be doing this? I think the safety of gene therapy has been remarkably good compared to other treatments. And I think it's just you have to design a trial, ask the right endpoints, and I don't think there's really any major concerns. What there will be is if you start doing in utero gene therapy or conditions where there may be genes that are taken up by germ cells. So it's actually transfer of DNA from a mother to a daughter or father to a son. Those are where those issues start to become more serious. Or if we're trying to modify embryonic stem cells, but that's more of a stem cell issue than it is a gene therapy issue. So I may have been given a too long an answer. I'm sorry.
Hi. I was just curious about future and possible limitations with cosmetic recombination.
Right.
If I wanted to change my eye color, hair color, or the permanent tan, would that be possible?
Right. Actually, I just did a podcast interview, or was going to be on the podcast for Nature last week on that very question, because how do you regulate gene therapy? So there are people who are injecting stem cells in the lips to make them plumper, put them in skin to make your skin look younger. There actually was an RNAi treatment for scleroderma where they showed that rubbing RNAi on the skin actually was therapeutic. So if that works there, there are other things you could do to make your skin color change or improve your appearance. So this area of gene therapy is a question of how do we regulate it? Should we regulate it? These people are going to Mexico, to China, to India, where there's not the same regulatory stuff. It's an issue. But for any therapy, there's been these cosmetic industries have started. There's also a concern, we talked about this over dinner, that Olympic athletes are now reported, some of them have been reported, actually of taking genes expressing erythropoietin to stimulate red blood cell levels, growth hormone, or others, and they can be hard to detect. So there may be gene doping instead of blood doping. So these are issues. And I really don't know how to approach the regulatory steps. I think in the U.S. you can limit it, but in other countries, it's going to be an issue. And so I think what it will do is it will prove whether gene therapy is really safe. If people are injecting themselves with plasmids, rubbing RNAi on their skin, injecting things in their eye to change their eye color, you know, we'll know very quickly if it's safe. But regulating, it's a huge problem. And in the cosmetic industry, if you go and Google stem cells in cosmetics, the number of companies that springs up is huge. Everybody's going to try to make the next big buck, you know, whether it's collagen or hyaluronic acid in the lips or a stem cell. The question is, in 5 years down the road, what happens to that stem cell? Is it going to be proliferating and cause cancer? People don't know. But.
So regarding integration,
yeah.
Right.
Entire mechanism, so this right. Could be way off base, but are people trying to like genetically engineer integrases to maybe conjugate to DNA binding protein that can target some area that they know is safe to integrate into?
It's an excellent question. The answer is yes. I think the best example is there's a company called Sangamo that what they do is they can engineer zinc fingers, which are these protein structures that could be used to give DNA binding affinity. And so they can actually genetically engineer zinc fingers to bind to any DNA sequence. So they're using these zinc fingers linked to the integrase to try to target the retrovirus to integrate to specific sites. I don't think the integration is going to work, but the zinc fingers actually can be used in other ways to target plasmids or DNA to specific sites. They also are using it for homologous recombination approaches, too. So the answer is yes, they're trying that. It's actually the retroviral integration is very hard to manipulate, but they're trying it with these zinc finger approaches to try to target specific sequences.
Thank you. I was just wondering if there were any ways that are not through vectors necessarily, like injecting things intracellularly, but perhaps, like, for example, when we see teratogens during, like, mm-hmm. embryonic development that affect your genetic modification. So my question is basically on epigenetics. How can we affect genes without necessarily having to recur to intracellular, like, injection of DNA?
Yeah, that's, I mean, obviously epigenetics leads hypo and hypermethylation of DNA, acetylation of DNA. All these things are very important for regulating genes. I mean, examples I can think of are that people have actually tried to deliver the genes, including the methylases or demethylases, to change that. How you can actually target specific methylations. I mean, there's, for thalassemia, it's been shown if you treat with azacitidine, which affects the methylation of DNA, that you can actually activate genes, including some of the minor globins. So that's actually been a therapy that's been used in some patients to try to change the methylation pattern of the DNA. The problem is it's not specific. So you kind of turn on a lot of other things that you may not want to turn on. So I don't really know how you target that per se. I think it would be very interesting if we can find ways to do it, that maybe people here in this room might be able to answer that question better than I can. But I don't know how you would target that. I mean, there are general effects of growth factors on that, changing the methylation levels of the methylases or demethylases have effects. But it's interesting. And I think epigenetics is obviously very important. You know, talking about gene transfer, but clearly changing the, you know, how DNA is modified, whether it's acetylation or methylation or whatever, it obviously affects gene expression of tumor suppressors, oncogenes, as well as other genes. Any other?
I just didn't fully understand how you modify the vector. You said that you remove the replication gene so that the virus doesn't replicate inside the human body, but I don't understand how you still made the virus replicate inside the cell culture.
Right. So the key is you take a cell in culture, modify the cell to express the viral proteins in that cell. So it's you make a modified cell type, which people have optimized, to make the proteins that the virus needs to replicate. But those genes encoding those proteins aren't carried into the target cell. So it's the engineering the cell line and culture to be able to grow the virus because it makes the viral proteins. And this has been done for adenoviral proteins, herpes proteins, retroviral proteins. Lentiviral proteins have been harder because some of them actually are toxic, so you have to do it in a transient type system. But for all these viruses, it's the same strategy. You take out the essential genes, express them stably in the cell line, and then use them to complement your defective vector. If that makes sense.
Thank you. As a researcher or investigator, could you comment on some of your frustrations? Would it be like getting funding or FDA or the science?
You're going to get me started here. We're supposed to be up there by 8:30. No, it's a...
I mean, just an insight for...
Yeah, I mean, obviously, NIH is affected by, you know, politics, wars, et cetera, and so funding has increased and decreased over the years, depending. I think if you want to refer to gene therapy specifically, I mean, gene therapy, it's been interesting because 15 years ago, I could write any grant that said gene therapy and it got funded. It was because it was the new therapy. But NIH only had a certain amount of time that they were willing to kind of put money towards that. Leukemia trials started, the leukemia came up, and those patients, Jesse Gelsinger died when they injected 10 to the 14th adenoviral particles into the liver. I mean, I can't write that many zeros. I mean, a lot of virus was injected into this patient, and they had a huge innate immune response. So I don't even think that's a good, you know, case of gene therapy is bad. It just was too, they gave too much. So when that happened, all funding was pulled. So now there's successes. I mean, it's actually working, and NIH is still slow to respond to that. In Europe, I go to the European Society of Gene Therapy meetings. Europe has actually passed us by when it comes to clinical gene therapy. Actually, the quality, 5 years ago, I always said they're not really doing cutting-edge science. It's they're now in gene therapy far superior. They have this network, they're interacting, they're foundations. So they've pushed that forward. So we'll see. There's been a push. The American Society of Gene Therapy has gone to Congress. We petitioned congressmen. I've learned that their attention span is about this long, because they hear 30 people come say, give me money for this and that. So it's really hard to convince them. So gene therapy is not getting the funding here that it used to, whereas in Europe, the money is far more accessible. And then the other problem, which is not really a problem, but the way NIH has been, how they fund things has changed. And so they're funding large clinical studies much more than small research studies or small trials, because their push is, their mandate is to develop therapies to treat human condition. And we researchers do mice real well. But making the transition to the clinic is very difficult, very expensive. And so they've tried to emphasize that, but the trials they've emphasized have been ones they think are safer. So they've been small molecule therapy, some biologics, but gene therapy hasn't been caught up in that transition. And it also means, because there's huge grants being funded, there's a lot less available, the number of grants have gone down. So funding is a big issue for us all right now, but I think in gene therapy it's going to go up, because there's successes, it's working. I think the safety profile is very good. They're going to see what's happening in Europe. Pharma has been, they were interested some years ago, but they've been hesitant recently, because the cost of developing these therapies and doing these trials and monitoring patients for 17 years, when they can develop a small molecule that doesn't work, but you can still sell it for a lot of money. I mean, obviously a lot of drugs work, but it's the strategy of, do you put money into a gene therapy that's expensive and you have to monitor the patients and there's this risk versus kind of a better aspirin. So pharma's backed off, but there's been kind of a resurgence. Pharma's saying, okay, we're seeing these things working. Maybe we'll start trying to fund it again. So I think, again, in 5 years, you'll see pharma entering back into the gene therapy arena. I think everybody put money into it before it was ready. They put in too soon, expected too much, and then they backed off. I don't know if I answered your question.
Hi, you mentioned that you had down-regulated IL-1.
Uh-huh.
What are the, for the arthritis, what are the adverse effects, if there are any, and how can you be sure that that will stay localized in the right. In the joints?
Right, so the reason why we chose this IL-1RA, so it's a protein that binds to the IL-1 receptor but doesn't induce signaling, so it seems to block signaling. It actually, Amgen has sold a protein called Kineret, which is the recombinant IL-1RA protein. They've sold it. It's not that effective because its half-life in the bloodstream is 30 minutes. So people have gotten huge infusions of this protein in every sort of way and no adverse effects. The problem is it hasn't been that effective, because its half-life is 30 minutes. And so we thought the safety profile was great. We don't want to completely block IL-1, you just want to down-modulate it. And that given this half-life of the protein, if you can get steady-state expression locally, it would be effective. And actually, it's amazing how effective a low-level expression of this protein has been if you put it into a joint, put it into an eye, or put it at other sites where there's inflammation. Much more effective than we ever would have imagined, and we've seen no adverse effects, because I think it's really just down-modulating something that doesn't even completely block. So we kind of view it as a rheostat. When you get inflammation, disease, IL-1 activity goes up, and you just want to try to bring it back down a little bit. So the safety profile of IL-1RA is spectacular. And that's the reason we chose it. The FDA is very happy with it. What they're concerned about more is that DNA that we're putting in. What happens to it? Does it integrate into the host genome? What happens? So they're more concerned about that aspect than the IL-1RA aspect. Yep.
Okay. Speaking of down-regulating interleukin-2, uh-huh. The interleukin, that made me think, if you just down-regulate interleukin to reduce inflammation, aren't you sort of patching the disorder or the disease instead of fixing it? Because right. That's kind of like, I don't know, made me think of like Tylenol, where you sort of just down-regulate like the inflammation, but not really treating the underlying disease.
No, you're absolutely right. So the best example is actually Amgen sells a drug that blocks TNF. So in inflammation, you have TNF, you have IL-1. They do everything. Those are really the two key targets for inflammation. So what people take, and I don't know if anyone in this room that's on Remicade or Intercept, but it's an inhibitor of TNF. It's used for inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, arthritis. It actually has effects in heart patients. Amazing. And so it's given systemically, blocks TNF. The moment you stop treating the patient, disease comes back. So it's only blocking pathologies associated with disease. It's not altering. It's not a disease-altering drug. So our thought with blocking IL-1 is you do the same thing, but you'd have chronic expression of it that would persist for periods of time. And we get high localized concentrations in the joint where, at least in osteoarthritis, most of the pathology occurs. So the thought is that we can halt disease. We're not going to cure disease, but we can halt progression of disease by sustained expression. Because currently what you have to get for the antibody or the protein is you get a sub-Q injection for the protein or the antibody, you have to get an intravenous injection every couple of weeks. Highly effective, but it's just, you have to get it routinely. And if you stop, disease comes back. And so our gene therapy for arthritis won't change the course of disease, but it hopefully will slow down progression. And the end point is that many of these people have to get artificial joints, knees and hips. And so you can measure time to joint replacement. It's actually an endpoint that they use. And if you can extend that, I mean, there's been economic projections what that can do if you can keep people walking longer, keep those artificial joints from going in. Although the artificial joint people say they're getting so good that it's actually better than a real joint. So there's a little discrepancy there.
And that's all the time we have for questions, so please join me in thanking Paul Robbins one more time.